she was still fretting. "I'm sorry." "No, don't apologize. Do you know what you need, my dear? You need a proper occupation." "I have a position." Mrs. Watson waved her hand. Morning light streaming into the room caught the lacy cuff of her sleeve. "We both know that being a lady's companion is not a good use for your time. But what is? Think about what you told me in the tea shop. Your ability to distill what others fail to see into startling insights." Mrs. Watson's eyes shone. "You lamented that it was a talent of no use whatsoever to a young lady who has been expelled by society, which, alas, is still true. But things have changed for Sherlock Holmes. That enigmatic gentleman is now famous in London and beyond, and his talents need not go unexploited." Charlotte forgot all about the roll half an inch from her lips. "Are you suggesting that..." Mrs. Watson pushed a piece of paper across the table to Charlotte. "Tell me what you think." Sherlock Holmes, celebrated consultant to the Criminal Investigation Department of the Metropolitan Police, makes available his services to private clients. Reasonable fees. Inquiries received at Box Blank, General Post Office. "You do not have a private box at the post office yet, but we will remedy that before we send the advert to the newspapers." The concept shocked Charlotte. Her parents would perish on the spot if they learned that she was advertising herself to the public. "Unless we can individually contact those who might have problems for you to solve," said Mrs. Watson gently. "How else will they know that they can benefit from your help?" The idea made sense. Of course she had to proclaim her services far and wide, in order to result in even a trickle of paying customers. And, of course, it had to be now, before the name Sherlock Holmes faded from memory. "But I am your companion, ma'am. How am I to fulfill my duties if I meet with clients and what not?"
"Ah, but this is so much better than having a paid companion. It would bore you to no end to do nothing but read to me and then listen to me ramble on. And frankly, it wouldn't be all that interesting to me either. This way, we embark on a venture together, a venture that has a fair chance of being profitable too." Mrs. Watson all but rubbed her hands together in anticipation. "Beyond paid advertisements, you will need an office, some cards and stationery, 3 quid a year to rent that private box at the post office, and, of course, all manner of incidentals. People always fail to plan for the incidentals. It is beyond your means now to set yourself up properly, but not beyond mine. The flat can be your office. I will foot the rest of the upfront expenses and take a cut of your fees as my recompense. But we don't know if I'll have significant enough fees for you to recoup your cost." "It's business, my dear Miss Holmes. Every investment carries a risk, but this one is a risk I'm more than willing to bear. In fact," she winked at Charlotte, "you need to be careful in your negotiations to make sure I don't take too large a share of your future earnings." "Ma'am," Mrs. Watson's expression turned solemn. "Miss Holmes, I was in the theatre. I have seen talented actresses hand over a shocking percentage of their earnings to men who took them on when they seemed to have few prospects. Do not make that mistake, my dear. Do not undervalue what you are ultimately worth because you are at a momentary disadvantage." The sensation of having at last met her real mother returned. Charlotte swallowed an unexpected lump in her throat.
"Yes, ma'am. I will remember that."
"Good." Mrs. Watson laid her hands over her heart. "Oh, Miss Holmes, we are going to have so much fun."
"My dearest Robert, I know I wrote only 2 hours ago, but I must let you know that a most delicious box of little cakes has arrived for me, compliments of Mr. Sherlock Holmes and his sister. The note that accompanied it explained that you had very much wished for me to have a taste of these Madeleine. My sweetling, how I adore you for always thinking of me, and marvel as usual at Holmes's astuteness, as you would not have expressed that desire aloud. Now to business. Holmes asked that I convey to you the significance of the maid not having opened the curtains. He wrote that he had not wished to say too much, in case the chemical analysis came to naught. But now that you have a mandate to investigate, you will want to know that such a thing hints strongly at improper relations between the maid and Mr. Sackville. I have never witnessed such goings-on in my father's household, and I dare say that my brother, for all his faults, is not one to take physical advantage of his stuff. He would be afraid of catching some dread disease. But too many young girls who toil in domestic service must deal with unwelcome advances as a cost of employment. Although, as much as I hate to cast aspersion on someone I have never met, and of whose circumstances I know very little, Becky Birtle, the young girl in question, seems to have been a willing participant, if indeed there were advances on Mr. Sackville's part. Had she entered the chamber to relight the fire before her master awoke, it would go without saying that she need not have approached the curtains, but then neither should she have disturbed him in his rest. But since her purpose was to give him his morning cocoa, she ought to have first opened the curtains and possibly the windows to let light and fresh air into the room. That she had approached and touched him without doing so first indicates her duties were hardly foremost on her mind. In fact, it might be the most charitable thing to be said, under the circumstances. But I do hope that this was not the case. Such a scenario makes me worry for the girl, and feel all too cynical about the world. I believe I shall comfort myself with a fresh cup of tea and a scrumptious madeleine that tastes as bright and lovely as a summer day in Tuscany. All my love, Alice. Inspector Treddles tapped a finger against his wife's letter and tried to decide whether the information that he had been provided was useful, or rather, whether it was useful in the correct direction. The discovery that the supply of strychnine had been tampered with at both doctors' places, along with Lord Ingram's disclosure that Lady Sheridan had been seen at Paddington Station, had firmly settled his suspicion on the Sheridans. The possibility of questionable conduct on Becky Birtle's part threw a wrench into his theories. The Sheridans made for great suspects. By ridding themselves of a brother they no longer loved, they would put an end to their perennial monetary worries. They had the sophistication, and despite the hollowness of their financial situation, the means to choreograph an intricate murder that presented as an accidental overdose. But lucre as a motive did present its problems. The Sheridans' shortage of funds was chronic rather than acute. They had dealt with it for decades without murdering anyone. Why should they start at this late stage in life? On the other hand, improprieties between Becky Birtle and Mr. Sackville were far more likely to ignite murderous passions in the here and now. Someone else could have been competing for Becky Birtle's affection. Tommy Dunn, the manservant who worked outdoors, perhaps. He was much closer to Becky Birtle's age, and a spurned young man could very well turn into a dangerous beast. Except no one flew into a rage and throttled Mr. Sackville, and Treddles couldn't see Tommy Dunn as the sort to arrange for an elaborate scheme that would leave no trace of his involvement. What about the other female servants? What if one of them had believed that she had an understanding with her master, only to discover he was also having his way with Becky Birtle? Might that not provoke a fury that had no equal in hell? "Inspector, there's a message from the chemical analyst for you," said Sergeant MacDonald.
Treadles read the cable.
What? What is it, sir? Asked MacDonald, wide-eyed.
Treadles needed a moment to gather himself.
Remember that I asked for Mr. Sackville's tissue to be tested for other poisons besides chloral?
He glanced at the telegram again.
They found arsenic.
15. A very different-looking curry house greeted Inspector Treadles upon his return. A fog had rolled in. The house drifted in and out of billows of vapour, a pale, ghostly vessel in a sea of mist. The character of the interior had changed, too. With the beauty of the coast obscured, it did not have the same airiness and sparkle. Instead, Treadles felt an intense isolation, made only more stark by the unrelenting prettiness of the decor. Before Treadles's arrival, Sergeant MacDonald, with two local constables in tow, had made a search of the entire property. Two sources of arsenic had been found. One, located in the kitchen, had been dyed red, as required by law to prevent accidental misuse. The other, a box of white arsenic kept for killing mice, was in the storeroom. This was more or less normal for a household of this scale and provided no immediate clues as to who might have used it. Not to mention, even though one had to sign for the purchase of white arsenic, with forethought a would-be poisoner could always find an unscrupulous chemist some distance away and make the transaction untraceable. For this was a poisoner with forethought. No arsenic had been found in the contents of the dead man's stomach, but it had seeped into his hair and nails, indicating a long-term poisoner at work. Then what happened? Why did the poisoner change tactics? What made it imperative that Mr. Sackville must die immediately rather than at an indeterminate future date? And did it have something to do with Becky Birtle having been a rather impertinent girl?
Can you tell me something of the traffic into and out of the storeroom, Mrs. Cornish?
They were again in her office, but the housekeeper didn't radiate as much command over her fiefdom as she had the previous time. Knowing that Mr. Sackville had been murdered couldn't possibly be easy on anyone at Curry House.
The storeroom is usually locked, she said with determined self-possession. Cake and biscuits are kept inside, and we don't want Jenny Price getting into them. But Mr. Hodges has a key. He took cocoa and sugar for making Mr. Sackville's morning cup. Mrs. Meek, too, when she wanted a nice tureen for soup. And sometimes I give Tommy Dunn my key. The staff receive 3 meals a day and tea besides. But it's hard work he does. I don't mind him taking a few extra biscuits for himself.
So everyone, other than Jenny Price, goes in and out of that room.
This wasn't helpful to Treadles's investigation at all.
That's right. There's no wine or beer in it. Those are in a locked cellar. No silver either. And no one has ever taken anything they oughtn't from the storeroom. But, Inspector, why are you interested in who can pinch arsenic when Mr. Sackville died of too much chloral?
Treadles glanced down at his notes.
You didn't mention Becky Birtle. Did she have access to the storeroom?
From time to time I asked her to fetch something for me. But surely you can't suspect a child?
Treadles didn't answer this question either.
The morning of Mr. Sackville's death, when you went into his room, had the curtains been opened yet?
Mrs. Cornish blinked.
I'm sure I don't remember. There was Mr. Sackville so cold and all. I paid no mind to the curtains.
Had the curtains been closed, you would have needed to open them to see.
I don't remember anything about the curtains. They must have been open.
She exuded respectability. It demanded nothing of Treadles's imagination to envisage her picture gracing the cover of the experienced English housekeeper. Would she lie? And, more importantly, if she lied, what was the reason? What would impel her to spare him the impression that the housemaid might have been up to no good?
I would like to see a photograph of Becky Birtle.
The abrupt change of subject had Mrs. Cornish reaching for her teacup. She didn't leave behind any.
Tell me something of her character, then.
Mrs. Cornish added what appeared to Treddles an excessive amount of sugar to her tea. Becky is at a trying age. She thinks she's a woman full grown and doesn't care to be told different. But she has a good heart. In a few years she ought to turn out a fine young woman.
When do you expect her to return to Curry House?
Oh, I can't tell you, Inspector. Now that her parents know Mr. Sackville was murdered, I dare say they wouldn't like for her to come back at all.
Did Treddles hear a note of relief in Mrs. Cornish's voice? She had reasons to be concerned for her own respectability. It would not reflect well on her, as head of the staff, if it became known that Becky Birtle had conducted herself in a questionable manner. But was that Mrs. Cornish's only worry?
You asked earlier, Mrs. Cornish, why I'm inquiring after arsenic when Mr. Sackville died from an overdose of chloral. The answer is we have found arsenic in Mr. Sackville, indicating that someone has been poisoning him.
Mrs. Cornish started violently.
No,
Treddles went on.
That someone most likely had frequent access to him. Since Mr. Sackville was more or less a recluse, that limits the suspects to members of the household.
But what a horrible thought!
Unfortunately, that is the case.
But he died of chloral. And no one in this house knows how to burgle two different doctors' places.
That was the puzzling part. But Treddles had learned in his years as a detective that those in service were a far more diverse lot than commonly presumed. It was not unheard of for the servant hall to harbour a few who had known the shadier side of life.
It is what every housekeeper supposes and hopes for, that those who serve under her are a meticulously law-abiding lot. But you do not know the background of everyone here, do you?
Reluctantly, Mrs. Cornish shook her head.
Who in this household would wish Mr. Sackville harm?
No one.
You know that is not true. Someone under this roof very much wished the master harm. You are responsible for the running of the place. You should know of any domestic tension that had the potential to mutate and fester.
Mrs. Cornish gripped her teacup with both hands.
Sir, you mustn't think this house was a hotbed of ill will. It was nothing of the sort.
It would be a thoughtless poisoner who makes his hatred widely known. Have you observed subtler signs of discontent and resentment?
I've never had any complaints against Mr. Sackville. Becky thought him a fine gentleman. Jenny Price adored him. Mrs. Meek is new here, and she's anyway the cheerful sort, always a good word for everything and everyone.
This did not sound to Treddles like a compliment. More the politeness of someone who could do with a bit less of that determined agreeableness.
Tommy Dunn thought the sun rose and set on Mr. Sackville's shoulders, and Mr. Hodges holds his cards close to his chest.
Treddles raised a brow, but only waited. Mrs. Cornish took a large gulp of her tea.
I used to think that he and Mr. Sackville rubbed along just fine. But last Christmas, when Tommy Dunn had the fob from the master and couldn't stop taking out his watch to check the time, Mr. Hodges looked at him as if he were an idiot. I thought maybe he was a little jealous. Tommy Dunn had no reason to receive a gift almost as fine as the one he himself got. When Mrs. Meek came, she was impressed with everything. Mr. Hodges would have this stony look on his face when she and Tommy Dunn agreed on how fine the house was, and what a grand gentleman the master was. One time he even got up and left the servants' hall.
Hodges, when called into the dining room to answer questions, immediately repudiated Mrs. Cornish's claims.
Maybe I did roll my eyes at Tommy Dunn a few times, but only because it was bordering on unseemly, how often he showed off that watch fob. A grown man ought to know better. I left the servants' hall that day after supper because it was about to rain, and I remembered I'd left my window open a crack. I was back 5 minutes later. And it wasn't Tommy Dunn Mrs. Meek was talking to at that time. It was Becky Birtle.
A thought came to Treddles.
You are sure it wasn't Miss Birtle speaking with Mr. Dunn? As far as I could tell, those two had nothing to say to each other.
This was odd. In a household full of older people, they were the only two youngsters.
Has it always been like that? Not always. When Becky first arrived, she talked a good deal to Tommy Dunn, and he was helpful to her. But then it all changed. He used to stay after supper to hear us talk, never said much himself, but wanted to listen, especially if we brought up places we'd been and sights we'd seen. Not long after Becky came, he stopped. Just left at the end of supper and went back to his own room.
This fit with the supposition that Tommy Dunn had perhaps been sweet on Becky Birtle and disappointed in his affection.
Is there anything else you can tell us, Mr. Hodges, that might help us in our investigation?
Hodges thought for a moment.
When I came back from my holiday for the inquest, the whiskey decanter in Mr. Sackville's bedroom was gone.
Did you look for it?
I asked Mrs. Cornish. She said she'd looked all over the house and couldn't find it.
Whiskey would have been a good means of administering arsenic. In fact, anything would have been a good means of administering arsenic. It was not for nothing that arsenic had been a favourite weapon in the poisoner's arsenal. The powder was odourless and tasteless, easy to disguise in food and beverage. Not to mention the symptoms of arsenic poisoning closely matched those of cholera, and in places where the water supply was not in question, could be blamed on gastric attacks.
I might as well let you know, Mr. Hodges, that arsenic was found in Mr. Sackville's body.
Hodges's hands closed into fists. He exhaled heavily a few times.
The tricks with the strychnine were ghastly enough. Arsenic too. How frequently did Mr. Sackville take his whiskey?
Almost.
Hodges blew out another shaky breath.
Almost every day. But he never took more than a thimbleful or two.
On what occasions did he not take it?
When the weather was warm, he might ask to have a glass of wine instead. The cellar keeps the wine cool.
I believe I've asked you this before, but let me ask you again, Mr. Hodges.
Do you know of anyone, specifically anyone in this house, who might have wished Mr. Sackville dead?
A muscle leaped at the corner of Hodges's jaw, but his answer was firm.
No. Do you know of anyone who might have wanted him to suffer?
The gastric attacks Mr. Sackville had endured in recent months were most likely not gastric attacks at all, but the effects of arsenic. Hodges unclenched and clenched his hands again.
No, Inspector. We don't have that sort of lowlife in this house.
Tommy Dunn echoed that opinion.
Ain't no master more generous than Mr. Sackville. And a new master mayn't even want us to work for him. Why would anyone hurt him?
He made a valid point. For a servant to poison the master of the house was for him to endanger his own livelihood, especially in a hired house like this, with no one coming to inherit the property. The next tenant might very well bring a full complement of retainers.
Treddles asked Dunn about Mr. Hodges leaving the servants' hall, while Mrs. Meek and someone else discussed the merits of the house and of the master.
"Was that you, or was that Becky Birtle?"
"Must have been Becky. Don't remember nothing like that."
"Weren't you there?"
"No, went back to me own room after supper."
"I understand you didn't get on with Becky Birtle."
Hostility darkened Tommy Dunn's face.
"She thinks too much of herself, that girl."
There was an excess of antagonism in his expression. A high opinion of herself couldn't be the only thing that bothered him about Becky Birtle.
"Did you feel a sense of affection for her before your sentiments turned?"
The young man snorted.
"What? You asking if I fancied her?"
"Yes."
"Never. She's a scrawny girl. Bony like a goat. Didn't do a thing for me."
"Then why did you come to dislike her?"
Dunn shrugged, but his jaw was held so tight a vein bulged on his neck.
"Like I said, she gave herself airs."
Something had happened to derail a once friendly enough association, but Treddles was not going to get it from Dunn.
"Do you know anything about a whiskey decanter that's gone missing?"
"Caught Mrs. Cornish in my room looking for it. She said she didn't think I took it, but someone might have hid it under my bed or something. Can't say I believed her."
Treddles did not enjoy this aspect of his work. A murder investigation unearthed not only deeply held, obsessively nursed grievances, but a plethora of everyday resentments, the undercurrents that would have otherwise remained beneath the surface for the foreseeable future. One didn't need to be naive to enjoy the idea of a harmonious household, where the master was gentlemanly and considerate, and the servants dutiful to their employer and kind to one another. To not believe in the possibility was to become the kind of cynic who suspected every ordinary establishment of seething with acrimony and discontent. And Robert Treddles had been such a fortunate man. He owed it to himself not to go down the all-too-easy route of scepticism and disenchantment. As there was nothing to be gained by interviewing Jenny Price again, Treddles called in Mrs. Meek, who arrived in a high state.
"Is it true, Inspector, that Mr. Sackville has been poisoned with arsenic?"
Treddles had expected that the news would have spread.
"I'd like to know who came to you with the information."
It might help him judge the differing degrees of rapport among the servants.
"Nobody came and told me. Mrs. Cornish looked all shaken when she walked past the kitchen, so I followed her and asked what was the matter. She told me. It was such awful news that I asked both Mr. Hodges and Tommy Dunn, too, because I didn't want to believe it."
She stared at Treddles, as if still hoping that he would reassure her otherwise.
"It is true," he said softly.
Immediately her gaze shifted to Sergeant MacDonald. The latter nodded, closing the last avenue of denial. Mrs. Meek slowly sank into a chair.
"But that's evil. Evil."
Treddles gave her a moment to collect herself.
"According to the answers you provided last time, when you reached Mr. Sackville's bedroom, one of the first things you did was to open the curtains. Is that correct?"
She looked at him in bafflement.
"What does that have to do with anything?"
"Please answer the question. Did you open the curtains?"
"I did."
"You are sure they weren't already open?"
Mrs. Meek sat up straighter. She bristled with the injured dignity of someone about to defend her integrity.
"I am completely sure, Inspector. We all rushed to Mr. Sackville's bedside. Feel him, Becky was yelling. So I did, and his temperature was all wrong. I looked up at Mrs. Cornish, but she wasn't looking at him. She was looking at the curtains. I remember this very clearly. It was still dim inside the room, but light was already seeping in around the edges of the drapes. Halo-like, if you will. Then Mrs. Cornish pulled open the curtains on her side, and I did the same on the window closer to me. There was an innocence to Mrs. Meek's reply, a resolute lack of insinuation. Treadles was reminded of his own obliviousness to the significance of the curtains. A thought occurred to him.
"Have you ever worked in any other position in a household, Mrs. Meek?"
"No, Inspector. I was always the cook. Cook's assistant early on, and then the cook." Perhaps she truly was plainly stating the facts. Perhaps she herself didn't understand the import of what she had revealed.
"How would you describe Becky Birtle?"
"Becky? She's a bit of a handful. I don't mind a high-spirited girl myself, but I think Mrs. Cornish was frustrated with her."
"Is she an attractive girl?"
"Not beautiful, but most girls that age are rather pretty. First bloom of youth."
"Is there a picture of her anywhere in the house?"
Mrs. Meek frowned. Oh, wait. I remember now. A travelling photographer came through recently. Mr. Hodges said that Mr. Sackville had paid for a photograph of the servants only the year before and wouldn't pay for another one so soon. But Mrs. Cornish said she'd pay for one herself. So we dragged some chairs outside and sat for the photographer, and he came back a few days later with a copy for Mrs. Cornish.
"Was Becky Birtle in the picture?"
"Yes, she was, standing right behind me." And yet Mrs. Cornish had been firm that there was no photograph of the girl in the house. Treadles made a note to speak to the housekeeper again before he left.
"Mr. Hodges tells me that a whiskey decanter went missing. Have you heard about it?"
A knock came on the door.
Even before Treadles answered, Constable Perkins, who had been assigned to accompany the detectives from Scotland Yard and facilitate matters for them, peeked in. The young man's face was flush with excitement.
"Inspector, Sergeant, a word, please."
Treadles raised a brow. For the constable to interrupt an interview, it had better be important. He murmured a word of apology and left the room, MacDonald in his wake.
"Inspector, the name Sergeant told me to check."
"What name, Sergeant?"
"When I was searching Mrs. Meek's room, sir," said Sergeant MacDonald, "I found letters addressed to a Nancy Monk. The name sounded familiar, but I couldn't quite remember. So I asked Constable Perkins to see if he could find out something more." "One of the men at the station remembered right away," said Perkins. "But we didn't want to rush, so we sent a cable on the Wheatstone machine to Scotland Yard, and they cabled back and confirmed our suspicions. Nancy Monk was the defendant in an arsenic poisoning trial 25 years ago. Everyone in the family died, except the master of the house, who was away on business. She took the stand to testify on her own behalf, and the jury came away convinced that she cared a great deal for the little children. And since there was never any evidence of anything between the cook and the master, she had a young greengrocer she was planning to marry, she was acquitted. And a quarter of a century later, she turned up in another case of arsenic poisoning.
When Inspector Treadles returned, Mrs. Meek was rocking back and forth on her seat, her fingers clutched tightly around the armrests. Treadles got to the point.
"Mrs. Meek, have you ever gone by another name?"
All the blood drained from her face.
"Why do you ask?"
He simply waited.
"I was framed!"
Her voice shot up an entire octave, giving her words a jagged edge.
"The man I worked for, it was him. His cousins had a sheep farm, and they kept white arsenic for dressing the wool. A month before everyone died, he visited his cousins.
He mixed that arsenic into the spare jar of snipped and pounded sugar I kept in the cupboard. And of course he made sure to be away on business when the sugar in the kitchen jar ran out and I started using sugar from the other jar. I brought the children milk with sugar and hot cocoa for the missus like I did every morning. They also had buttered toast sprinkled with sugar. You can't imagine their suffering that day. I was frantic with worry. But I never thought they were poisoned, and I never thought I'd be charged. She wasn't a pretty or clever woman, but she tried to make the best possible home for him, and the children were sweet and loved everything I cooked. I was happy to hear that their father, when he proposed to the daughter of a business associate less than a year later, was turned down. I was even happier to learn that he died on his cousin's sheep farm after he was gored by an angry ram. Perhaps God wasn't blind and deaf after all. She knotted her fingers together, fingers that were large and rough from work. But if that was justice from above, it came too late for me. My young man, he believed that I was innocent, but his mother wouldn't let him marry anyone who'd been through such a public trial, not to mention she was afraid I'd poison her. And I couldn't stay in Lancashire anymore. I had to say goodbye to him, move far away, change my name, and make a new life for myself. The former Nancy Monk looked up at Treddles, her gaze direct and honest. I did not poison Mr. Sackville. And if you check with my previous employer, I served her for 20 years, you'll find that I told the truth. She was sorry to see me go, and I'd have stayed on, but I'm not so young anymore, and it was too much work feeding 24 dyspeptic ladies day in and day out.
We will most assuredly be checking with your previous employer, said Treddles.
Her distress was so palpable that he found it difficult to breathe. He wanted to believe her, but he could not allow his own sympathies to muddy the investigation.
And what do you intend to do in the meanwhile, Inspector?
Mrs. Meeks's shoulders slumped.
Arrest me.
Treddles sighed inwardly.
I do not plan to, yet. But I strongly caution you to remain in this house, or be considered a fugitive from the law.
Treddles did not forget about the photograph, but Mrs. Cornish had a ready explanation. Becky took it with her when she left. She wanted to go home, but she was afraid her parents wouldn't let her leave again. So she asked for the photograph as a memento.
Treddles nodded. During my interviews with other members of the staff, I learned of a whiskey decanter that you were searching for, Mrs. Cornish. You failed to mention it to me.
Mrs. Cornish sucked in a breath.
But that has nothing to do with the case.
There's never been any theft in this house for as long as I've been here, and I was upset that as soon as Mr. Sackville died, somebody thought it was all right to swipe something of his. On the face of it, this was a plausible enough explanation. But then again, if one merely went by appearances, there would not be an investigation into Mr. Sackville's death.
Did you ever find it?
No, said the housekeeper immediately.
Do let us know if it turns up.
Of course, Inspector. Mrs. Cornish smiled tightly. Of course. 16. The response to Sherlock Holmes's advertisement in the papers was beyond anything Charlotte could have anticipated. Even Mrs. Watson declared herself more than gratified by the influx of inquiries. There were, as she had cautioned Charlotte, a number of letters that had nothing to do with perplexing issues that needed unravelling. Several missives scolded Sherlock Holmes for interfering in matters that were none of his concern, one purporting to be from a friend of Lady Amelia's, another a relation of Lady Shrewsbury's. A few others claimed friendship and kinship with the fictional Holmes, expressing hope for renewed acquaintance,
and perhaps some financial assistance. The ones that amused her the most were a half dozen or so marriage proposals from women who didn't want the singular genius of their time to lack the warmth and solicitude of a good wife. There was even a gentleman convinced that Holmes must be of the Uranian persuasion. Great men, in my observation, are more likely than not to harbour a deep love for other great men. I therefore urge you to join our society and together strive to overturn the prejudices that would condemn us and the barriers that would have us always be outsiders, fearful of discovery and banishment. I would join his society in a heartbeat, said Charlotte to Mrs. Watson. But I fear I shall disappoint him bitterly. A portion of the remaining inquiries were rejected right away as spurious. This man asserts that he has an income of £4,000 a year and wants to know whether his fiancée is sincere in her affection for him or only for his money, Mrs. Watson scoffed. Look at this paper. I should be surprised if he has an income of £400 a year. Another letter, from a young woman who worked in a florist shop and was puzzled by the conduct of a customer who always bought a single rose, but suddenly bought a bouquet of yellow zinnias, seemed legitimate enough to Mrs. Watson. But Charlotte, after looking at it, declared it fabricated. Lord Ingram is an accomplished calligrapher, and he has taught me that while it is possible for a person to master more than one style of handwriting, it takes a great deal of practice to achieve fluidity in the flow of the letters, and even when one does, there might still be noticeable hesitation at the beginnings and the ends of words. In fact, looking at the script, I would guess the writer to be working for a newspaper. Mrs. Watson's eyes widened. There had been a number of inquiries from the papers wishing for a word with Mr. Holmes, which they'd promptly discarded. Charlotte grinned. No, his handwriting didn't tell me that, but the letter is postmarked very close to the premises of the Times. Our would-be trickster didn't realize that he had better be more committed to his fraud if he wanted a face-to-face meeting with the mysterious Sherlock Holmes. Their first actual client at 18 Upper Baker Street was a young man with a pink, eager face. He had been courting a lovely young lady. Her birthday was in 3 weeks, and he had asked what he ought to give her. In response, she had given him a riddle to test the depth of his devotion. What I'd like to receive is to be found at the beginning of the year, in the middle of the longest word in the dictionary, at the bottom of the stairs, and the end of eternity. Does this turn you upside down? Then you must flip yourself the right way around. Charlotte disappeared into Sherlock's bedroom for 3 minutes, then returned with a big smile on her face. My brother has solved the riddle for you. If you take the letter at the beginning of the word year,
I did try that route earlier, said the young man. The beginning of the word year yields the letter Y. Bottom of the stairs would give me S, and end of eternity another Y. But what's the longest word in the dictionary?
That would depend on the dictionary, wouldn't it? But the longest word in the word dictionary is itself.
The young man gasped with delight. And the letter in the middle of the word is,
Charlotte waited patiently until he exclaimed,
Oh, it's O.
I do believe you are correct, sir.
But what do Y, O, S, and Y give me?
Your young lady did warn you that everything might be upside down, did she not? So let's reverse her directions. The ones that are reversible, in any case. If we take the end of the year, the top of the stairs, and the beginning of eternity, middle of the dictionary is still middle of the dictionary, then what do we have?
The young man thought for a minute. R-O-S-E. Roses,
She wants roses. I can get her roses.
He left, beaming. Mrs. Watson, who had volunteered to look after the administrative aspects of their enterprise, accompanied him out. Since neither Charlotte nor Mrs. Watson had any first-hand knowledge of what would be a fair price for Sherlock Holmes's services, the latter had decided to make it 7 shillings for a meeting that solved the problem. It's a bit more than what a doctor would charge for a call, but not much more. And there's only one Sherlock Holmes. Mrs. Watson returned, beaming from ear to ear. Charlotte rose from her chair.
I can't believe it. He paid.
Mrs. Watson had reassured her that of course her clients would pay. But to Charlotte, the entire enterprise still felt like a mirage. An elaborate Fata Morgana castle in the sky. That she might turn nothing more than a few minutes of time and a bit of thinking into actual money. Enough money for a week of room and board in a halfway respectable place. Oh yes, he paid. Most willingly, too. The mischief and satisfaction on Mrs. Watson's face. Charlotte's jaw dropped.
What did you tell him my fee was?
A guinea.
A guinea was 21 shillings, 3 times what they had agreed to charge. Charlotte gaped at Mrs. Watson.
But that's a fortune.
Yes, but allow me to know better in this case. He confirmed that he is very well off, did he not, when you told him what you knew about him? The young man's family was successful in manufacturing, but still, a guinea. It isn't so much about what he can afford, but more about, well, not overcharging. Mrs. Watson pressed the heavy coin into Charlotte's palm and closed her fingers around it.
Remind yourself that you're far more likely to undercharge than overcharge, my dear, because you don't yet understand your own value, and you've never been taught to demand your full worth. She smiled. That's why I appointed myself the bursar of this operation, because I've had to learn both.
Their second client was a timid woman of about 30, who had misplaced an emerald ring her husband had given her, and was desperate to find it before he returned home from a business trip. Charlotte located the ring at the bottom of the woman's hatpin holder. Mrs. Watson charged her 9 shillings, plus outlay for their return trip in a hansom cab, which the client was more than happy to pay, besides gifting them with a ham pie for poor Mr. Holmes, who can't leave his room.
If this keeps up, we might bring in more than £500 a year,
Charlotte marvelled as they settled into a cab. Mrs. Watson patted the aigrette on her bonnet.
£500 isn't an astonishing sum, my dear Miss Holmes.
But it's as much as I ever hoped to make, after many years of school, training and experience.
Well, we may not bring in 500 a year, since we may not always have a steady supply of clients. Or we could bring in much more, if we have a few dukes and princes, whose secretaries I'll bill 50 quid apiece, said Mrs. Watson with great relish. And don't you worry that I'll overcharge them. Not every nobleman is in dire financial straits. The Duke of Westminster has an income of £250,000 a year.
Charlotte couldn't help laughing.
My dear lady, I feared to impose on your kindness. I see now that I needn't have worried. You are a shark.
Mrs. Watson preened a little, evidently pleased by Charlotte's observation.
A shark with a good nose for money in the water, but, let's say, rather soft teeth.
Miss Livia, said the maid. There's a woman to see you. She says her name is Rajkumari Indira.
Livia looked up from the frame of embroidery on which she hadn't made any progress in days.
What?
Occasionally one did see an Indian princess in London, but the Holmeses had few ties with the subcontinent, and did not move in the kinds of circles that hobnobbed with foreign dignitaries, why in the world would one call on her? In the parlour, a woman draped in scarlet and gold silk stood at the window, her back to the room, her hair covered by a very long shawl that had already wrapped around her person once. At Livia's entry she turned around, the shawl drawn across her face, concealing everything except her eyes. When she saw that Livia had come alone, she dropped her hand from the edge of the shawl. "Charlotte!" Charlotte placed a finger over her lips, signalling Livia to be quiet. Livia ran across the room and embraced her sister.
"Oh, Charlotte!"
Then she pulled back.
"My goodness, you are practically naked."
The blouse Charlotte wore ended just beneath her breasts. The shawl, drawn diagonally across the body from hip to shoulders and then back around, covered most of the exposed portions of Charlotte's torso, but from the side one could easily see 4 inches of skin.
"It's so nobody looks at my face."
Charlotte laid a hand on Livia's arm.
"Are you all right, Livia?"
"I'm well enough. People don't actually believe that I did away with Lady Shrewsbury, but it gives them something to speculate about in the meanwhile."
The situation was a little less promising than that. The discovery of arsenic had tongues wagging that while Mr. Sackville might have been murdered, he had to have been done in by someone local, most likely one of his servants, leading to the current consensus that his death had nothing to do with Lady Shrewsbury's and Lady Amelia's. With the suspicion for those latter deaths once again falling squarely on Livia and Sir Henry respectively, which must be the reason Charlotte had taken the risk to come see her.
"You've become too thin," said Charlotte softly.
"It was always more enjoyable to watch you eat than to eat myself."
Livia took Charlotte's face in her hands.
"At least you haven't become too thin."
"Mrs. Watson feeds me round the clock, and I haven't turned anything down. But at the rate I'm going, within the week I'll reach maximum tolerable chins. Then I'll be obliged to give up this reckless dining."
Livia chuckled. Charlotte took Livia's hands in her own.
"If only there had been an inquest, at least in Lady Shrewsbury's case."
Livia sighed.
"Don't worry."
Charlotte came beside Livia and placed an arm around her shoulder.
"Inspector Treddles will get to the bottom of this. He is very good at what he does."
Charlotte didn't possess the instinct to comfort. Livia well knew this. When they'd been girls, Charlotte remained in her corner of the room and observed, as Livia battled with her sometimes overwhelming feelings of inadequacy and insignificance. But over the years her sister had learned that it made Livia feel less alone, less despair-stricken, to be gently stroked on the back, or embraced, or patted on the arm. Really, any kind of contact at all. And the odd thing was, knowing that Charlotte was not naturally inclined to physical closeness, made her touches not less effective, but more. They were not a reflexive reaction to the distress of another, but a considered one. Livia leaned on her sister and finally gave voice to the fearful thought that tumbled day and night in the back of her head.
"What if Inspector Treddles gets to the bottom of it, only to find out that Mr. Sackville's butler did it?"
Leaving Livia forevermore known as the woman who probably had something to do with Lady Shrewsbury's death. Her entire life she had been frustrated by her invisibility. At home she was the last daughter her parents remembered. In society the women were prettier, livelier, younger, cleverer, or even more pathetic. She knew of at least one instance in which a widower offered for a plain, penniless spinster, who would otherwise have to endure a lifetime under the thumb of a tyrannical brother. Whereas Livia always seemed to carry her own special shield of obscurity everywhere she went, behind which she could stand in the middle of a room and not be noticed.
how she'd yearned to be the centre of attention, and how cruel to be taught this way that she ought to be careful what she wished for. "Inspector Treddles will apprehend real suspects in no time," said Charlotte. "You have my assurances as a consultant to the Criminal Investigation Department."
Livia snorted.
"This reminds me. I saw the advert for Sherlock Holmes's services. Are you really taking clients? How do you keep up the pretense?"
Charlotte explained the procedure she and Mrs. Watson had established.
"I saw my first two clients this morning. We already made 30 shillings. "So fast?" "Yes. And I have another client lined up for the afternoon."
She opened her reticule, took out a small pouch, and put it in Livia's hand. Livia didn't have to open the pouch to know it was the jewellery and money she'd given Charlotte the night she had run away. She gave it back.
"It's too early. You don't know that you'll still have clients in a week or a month, and I still have reservations about this Mrs. Watson."
Charlotte shook her head.
"I'm more worried about you now than I am about myself. You take it. Mrs. Watson has invested her own funds to set up Sherlock Holmes's operation, so she has every motive to keep me around and in good shape until she at least recoups her cost."
Livia stared down at the pouch.
"Oh, Charlotte, what is going to happen to all of us?"
"According to my crystal ball, Mrs. Watson will make a fortune. I will make a name. You will clear your name, as will Papa. And Mama will feel relieved for a short while, and then more aggrieved than ever."
"Oh, God, if only, if only." "While we are looking through your crystal ball, can you tell me if I'll always be stuck at home with Mama and Papa?"
"Only if you want to be, Livia," said Charlotte softly. "Only if you want to be."
"Lady Sheridan, thank you for seeing me on such short notice," said Inspector Treddles. Lady Sheridan smiled without warmth.
"Your note did not leave much room for refusal or delays, Inspector."
She was a small, fine-featured woman, her grey hair swept back in a precise and severe chignon. But whereas her husband was hale and vigorous, Lady Sheridan reminded Treddles of nothing so much as her townhouse, a once beautiful entity, made worn by time and adverse circumstances.
"I apologize for the necessity of the intrusion," Treddles said as gently as he could. "But we have an eyewitness account of your return to Paddington Station from a Great Western train. The eyewitness, who has been interviewed by my colleague, is entirely certain that she saw you on the day Mr. Sackville died, and even produced her diary entry to bolster her claim."
"Lady Avery kindly sent a message to that effect." A note of irony lined her words. "I did return to London that day. I am one of the patronesses of the Young Women's Christian Association and attended the opening of a new centre in Bath, which took place before numerous witnesses. Then I got on a train the next day and came back."
"You didn't go to Stanwell Moot?"
"It would have been a fairly convenient side trip from Bath."
"I assure you, Inspector, I never set foot in Stanwell Moot."
Unfortunately, that was probably true. Constable Perkins's conscientious legwork had not produced a shred of evidence that either of the Sheridans had ever visited the village or its vicinities.
"I was also told that you were once very fond of Mr. Sackville, that you lamented that he had drifted away from the family. Lady Avery said you claimed not to know why he cut off contact, but there is a very real possibility that you knew and chose not to tell her, as she was liable to repeat what she learned to others."
"An astute observation."
The expression on Lady Sheridan's face was almost a smile. Treddles found himself warming up to the old woman at this sign of almost approval. He had to issue a stern reminder to himself that she was still a prime suspect. "Can you elucidate us as to why Mr. Sackville